So I realize that this is a pretty diverse audience. On the one hand, we have, you know, very theoretical physicists who know all about general relativity. On the other hand, we have people who are interested, who are brought together by a common interest in computing, but maybe, you know, the last physics course they saw was quite a while ago. So we're going to hope to say something that at least everybody will find interesting at some point during the talk. So I'm going to be talking about black holes. And as you know, black holes are a prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Actually, general relativity is a terrible name, right? It should have been called just Einstein's theory of gravity, because that's what it is. And in this theory, space and time get curved or warped by the presence of matter and energy. And Einstein's equations describe exactly quantitatively how that happens. The equations are extremely complicated, very difficult to solve. And we have a really handful of analytic solutions that basically all of our intuition is based on. And so numerical relativity, which is this field of using supercomputers to solve Einstein's equations numerically, has the promise of allowing us to really study this theory, which, after all, is a highly nonlinear theory of the gravitational interaction. So I'm going to be talking also about gravitational waves. Let me just explain what a gravitational wave is. So a good analogy is if you think about dropping a pebble into a pond of water, then the ripples travel out, right? We call those water waves. So you can think of a gravitational wave as a ripple that travels out. It's a ripple in the curvature of space-time. And the effect of it, if it arrives at some detector on the Earth, so imagine I set up a ring of test particles, completely free particles, they only interact by gravity. The gravitational wave comes by, it will squeeze this ring of particles, shortening the distance in one direction while stretching it the other, and half a cycle later, reverse. Okay, so that's shown over here. And there are two polarizations, just like for electromagnetic waves. The big difference is for electromagnetic waves, the polarization axes are at 90 degrees to each other. For gravitational waves, it's 45 degrees. Right, exercise for the graduate students in physics, why is it 45 for gravitational waves? So the effect on a detector is measured by this amplitude h, which is the dimensionless strain, right? It's the change in the distance over the distance. Now, here is a theorist's view of a real gravitational wave detector that an experimentalist can build. And it basically uses an interferometer. So we have two mirrors here and another two this way. We send a laser beam in, it bounces back and forth. And we get interference fringes here at this output. And if this was completely still, the pattern of interference fringes would be completely stationary. Now imagine a gravitational wave comes down, say, from the top. It squeezes this distance a little bit while stretching this one and then reverses. So you'll see a shifting pattern of fringes over here. And in principle, you can get a very high precision on the length measurement here and hope to detect the gravitational wave. Now, in order, remember that the strain H was delta L over L, so you want to make the L, this distance, as big as possible. And basically, that's just limited by your budget, right? You want to build it on the ground. How long a tunnel or how long a tube are you willing to pour concrete for, right? And the answer is 4 kilometers, right? That's what the federal budget decided would be a good number to do. Okay, so we're going to make a detector 4 kilometers long. You can estimate how big the H would be from some astrophysical event, you know, two black holes of a few solar masses smashing into each other at half the speed of light at some appropriate distance. It's very, very tiny. h to the 10 to the minus 22. So the delta L you're trying to measure is 10 to the minus 16 centimeters, which is 10 to the minus 3 times the diameter of a proton, not the diameter of an atom, right? The diameter of a proton. So, or 10 to the minus 12 of the wavelength that you're trying to measure. How do you do this? The answer, it's a miracle. Okay? If you want to know how it's really done, I can talk about it later on. Okay, so here is LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. This is in Hanford in the state of Washington. Here's a tube 4 kilometers long. Inside this, there's an evacuated pipe, which is about that wide. And hanging in that are the mirrors that I showed schematically earlier. Okay, this is quite an old picture now. They've paved the parking lot and it looks a little bit better. Now, if they actually reported that they had detected something, right, nobody would believe them. Right? They'd say, oh, come on, you know, it was somebody slamming a car door in the parking lot, right? So they built another one. It's in Livingston, Louisiana, just outside Baton Rouge. Other than the topography here, you can see it's the same design. I've been told there are alligators in the water here. I don't know if that's a true story or not. Anyway, the idea is that if you see events simultaneously in these two detectors, you can rule out to very high confidence that the signal is terrestrial, right? You can assume that it's some event that's coming to us from some astrophysical event. Okay, so where does numerical relativity come in? Well, we want to be able to predict the gravitational wave signatures that will come from various events, and we want to do it for two reasons. One of them, as I'll explain a little later, we can actually improve the sensitivity of the experiment. I'll explain why that's so in a while. And then the other one, of course, is we want to compare the theory and the experiment. So let me explain that second thing. So we know already we have astrophysical evidence, a few dozen cases, where people claim that a black hole has been detected. Right? I'm now talking about solar mass type black holes. And, you read in the newspaper every now and again, black hole detected, something or other. Okay, that's not true. Okay? What we do know from astronomical observations is there are places in the universe where there's a lot of mass in a small volume. If general relativity is correct, then these things are black holes. But we don't have any independent check, any independent measure that we have all these crazy properties. There's an event horizon, the surface of the black hole, that acts like a one-way membrane, or that the geometry of space-time around the black hole is distorted in this particular way that's predicted by the theory. In fact, we're not much better off than in this cartoon, right? That's where we are. So we want to find out, because black holes are so important, because they test the full nonlinear structure of the theory. All the tests up till now, the solar system tests, the perihelion precession of Mercury and things like that, those are really weak field tests of general relativity. And theorists are very good. They can construct other theories that agree with all these solar system experiments, but make very different predictions in strong field regimes. So that's why this is so important. Okay, so here's a conceptual diagram of two black holes in an orbit around each other, a binary system. They orbit around, they emit gravitational waves, they lose energy, they come closer together. There's some merger phase, and then afterwards you have a single black hole, and it just kind of settles down like the ringing of a bell. And there's some schematic waveform here. Now, this early stage, when the black holes are far apart, the geometry is still relatively weak, the deviations from flat space, so we can make analytic approximations. We can use a thing called the post-Newtonian expansion here, which is pretty good at predicting the initial waveform. The end part here, we can also use a kind of perturbation theory because this is close to a static black hole, right? Just a single spinning black hole. In fact, my PhD thesis was to work this out. Okay. It's this middle phase where nothing is small. And here's where we need the supercomputer simulations, right, to get us to connect this to that. Now, starting in about the mid-1990s, computers got powerful enough that people began to think about doing fully three-dimensional simulations in general relativity. And for the first 10 or dozen years or so, it was a very frustrating experience. Because typically, you would run your simulation, you know, at some particular accuracy, say this. So what's plotted here is some constraint on, I'll explain this a little more in a while, which is supposed to be zero if you have an accurate simulation. And, you know, you would go along, simulating along, and then suddenly your simulation would blow up. And nobody really understood what this was, even. I mean, how can you fix a problem when you don't know what's causing it? You know, was it some numerical problem? Are we using a bad numerical method? There's coordinate freedom in general relativity. Did we have a bad coordinate choice? And it turned out that it wasn't that it was something called constraint violation, which I'm going to explain in a minute. But you can see here's a constraint that should be zero, and then as you increase the accuracy of the simulation, right, it blows up earlier and earlier, but if you extrapolate this back, you'll see it starts here 10 to the minus 16, which is the machine precision. So just tiny round-off errors are enough to produce an unstable evolution. All right, so where does that come from? So all you need to know about general relativity, you've got 10 equations for 10 components of what's called the metric tensor. So in 3 spatial dimensions and 1 time dimension, this is a 4x4 symmetric matrix, 10 independent numbers. But there are 4 degrees of freedom to make coordinate transformations on x, y, z, and t. And so you have an overdetermined system. You have too many equations to determine the physics. And what happens is, if you just pick, you know, 6 of the equations and use those to solve the problem, you're not guaranteed that the other 4 equations will remain satisfied. And in fact, typically they don't. Even a 10 to the minus 16 error will blow up exponentially. And just to make the point, let me show you there's an analogous thing even in electromagnetism. This is half of Maxwell's equation. So this is an evolution equation. And it says that if I have initial values for the E field, 3 components here, I can propagate this forward in time using this equation. But I have to satisfy this constraint equation, which doesn't have time derivatives. And analytically, it's an exercise for graduate students, or even undergraduates, to show that if this is satisfied at t equal to 0, then this equation, you just take a divergence of this, guarantees that it remains satisfied. But that's an analytic guarantee, not a numerical guarantee. And in fact, it's well known, even people have known this for a long time in plasma physics and so on, that this constraint will blow up unless you take special measures to make sure it remains satisfied. So Einstein's equations are a lot more complicated. The constraints are not the form of simple divergences and so on. But the idea is basically the same. And unfortunately, all the tricks that the plasma physicists had worked out for doing these simulations didn't apply to Einstein's equations because it wasn't a divergence and the equations were also nonlinear. But eventually, Franz Pretorius was a postdoc at Caltech, 2005. He made the first successful stable simulation of a full black hole evolution. And then after that, very quickly, several other methods were developed. And, you know, by now, in fact, this number's a little low. It's more like 15 or so different groups around the world have gotten into this area. So I'm going to describe some results from what we call the SXS collaboration, simulations of extreme space times. And This started in my group at Cornell, but then unfortunately graduate students have a habit of graduating and diffusing out. And so now we have actually quite a large collaboration. Everybody is working on these problems together. All right, now let's talk about how do you increase the sensitivity of an experiment by doing computer simulations? And the answer is related to how LIGO is actually going to search for these gravitational wave signals. The way you do it is you have some kind of template bank of possible gravitational wave signals. So, for example, up here is a possible gravitational wave signal from two black holes that are spiraling in. You notice how the amplitude it gets bigger and the frequency increases. Now, suppose you take this signal and you bury it. It's this red thing, this tiny little amplitude in here, buried in all this random noise in the detector output. Well, if you do a cross-correlation of your template with this output here, then what happens is whenever there's noise, all the ups and downs, the sinusoidal variation of the template, tend to cancel out. They average to zero. But if you slide this exactly over that point there, then all the ups match up and all the downs match up. You get a big cross-correlation, right? So that's this red point here. And that would then become a candidate event that you would then study more carefully. So you can see that in order to do this, you need a good template bank. You need good predictions, a priori predictions, of what you're looking for. Okay. Now, you can't do enough simulations. You know, in order to do this, you need, if you think about it, it's an eight-dimensional space here of parameters, even just for a simple case of two black holes. You can't do enough simulations to fill, you know, all possible values of masses and spins and eccentricity that you might want to search for. A typical simulation might take a month of supercomputer time on many, many processes on some big cluster. So what you want to do is you have semi-analytic waveforms, models for these things, which you have to calibrate with numerical simulations. And that's where that's why this has been very important. Okay, where does the urgency come from? So this is a diagram. So our galaxy, or the Earth, if you like, is at the center. And this is sort of the local neighborhood of our universe. This is a scale of about 300 megaparsecs, or about a billion light years. And this colored circle in here, this was the reach, the distance out to which the initial configuration of LIGO would have seen an event if something happened in that particular volume. Since then, LIGO has been upgraded, so you keep the same vacuum system. That's what's expensive, and it's relatively cheap to upgrade the lasers and the suspension system and all of that kind of thing. And so the reach of LIGO has been extended now by a factor of 10. That increases the volume by a factor of 1,000, so the potential event rate is 1,000 times greater. And astrophysicists are pretty confident that with this reach, LIGO should start seeing events. And LIGO should reach, the construction is complete, they're doing the commissioning now, should reach design sensitivity in probably about 3 years. So that's the time. This will be a very exciting thing. It's the analog of the search for the Higgs boson. It's something that we're very confident is there. You know, I hate to say it, but you know, if we don't see it, it's even more interesting. You know, try explaining that to a congressman. Anyway, we're very excited about this coming up. So, how accurate do you need to make these simulations? All right, this is a complicated question, but just roughly, you want to keep phase accuracy in the wave. Right, because if you go out of phase, then when you do the cross-correlation, the ups will no longer line up with the ups. They'll line up with the downs, right? And then your template doesn't increase the signal-to-noise ratio. So you need a fraction of a radian. You know, it turns out about 0.05 or so. And you also need to do this on quite a large number of orbits. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then after you've detected a signal, if you actually want to go back and try to refine how good are the parameters, you actually need an even better accuracy. So the current status of this is that the simulations are probably okay for simple waveforms, equal mass, no spin, probably okay for low spins, but they're not good for high spins, and I'll talk about this precession in a minute, and certainly not good enough to be able to do this with any reliability. In the sort of long future, there are plans to put these kinds of detectors in space, laser interferometer, space antenna, Lisa, and look for signals from supermassive black holes that we believe are at the centers of galaxies. And the signal to noise there should be even better. You'll need even better phase accuracy. So how do you get higher accuracy? Well, the key point is that solutions of Einstein's equations are smooth as long as you're away from the singularities. So you should use high-order numerical methods. Now, in standard finite difference techniques, right, the way you get high order, suppose I want to evaluate the derivative of my field at this point. So the simplest approximation would be I'd use, say, these two neighbors, take the difference there, divide by two delta x, and that would give me an approximation to the derivative. And then to get higher order, I can keep going out, adding more and more points. And that's actually a well-behaved numerical procedure. The problem is, when you come to the boundary of your domain, there are no points on the other side. So if you want to get high order, you have to use coefficients that are all on one side of the boundary. And this is not well-behaved. The coefficients in these formulas get bigger and bigger with alternating signs. And so everything tends to cancel out to give you this small derivative. So this is not a numerically stable procedure. But with spectral methods that I'm going to describe in a minute, you avoid this problem. Spectral methods use all the points in the domain to compute the derivative, no matter where you're estimating it. The trick is you give up the uniform spacing. There's a very specially chosen spacing of the points which tends to cluster near the endpoints. All right, so let me explain a little bit more how this is. So basically, you approximate the solution as an expansion in basis functions. All right, so here's the basis function phi k of x. These are some coefficients. Now, in a spectral method, a real spectral method, right, the way you get these coefficients is you use the orthogonality of these basis functions. You just project this with a basis function that gives you the coefficient. In a pseudo-spectral method, which is, you know, got a quite a, by numerical standards, an ancient pedigree, you replace this projection with a quadrature, right? So it's a finite procedure to estimate this. And the trick is, by using the specially chosen points, that this approximation is as good as this one for practical purposes. And then the other advantage, what's the pseudo part? Well, the other part is, if you have a linear problem and you can handle these, you know, this is sort of very nice, but how do you handle a nonlinear problem? Okay, you don't want to be, if you think about Fourier series, if I have to multiply two Fourier series, I get a convolution. Well, what do I do if I have a logarithm or a, you know, fifth power of something? You can see it gets very complicated. So what you do is, you use the collocation points, the points in spatial coordinates, to these things, you treat these as your unknowns instead of these coefficients here. Physicists can think of this as transforming back and forth between momentum space and physical space, right, which is just a Fourier transform and an inverse. All right. And the big advantage of these methods is you get what's called exponential convergence for smooth solutions. That means that as you increase the n, the order of the approximation, the errors decrease faster than any power of n. Now, how do we handle black holes? After all, black holes have a singularity inside. So the simplest thing you could think of is to cut that out of the computational domain. So in the early days, what people would do is they would have some, here's the boundary of the black hole, they would have some finite difference grid, and then, you know, use some stencil of points to estimate, say you needed a derivative at this point, and then if the black hole is moving, you have to keep changing your mind about what stencil of points to use. And that's very difficult to do, and nobody really had much success with that. Now, you can't even think about doing this with spectral methods because spectral methods use all the points in the subdomain. You can't leave some out. So instead, we came up with a method that we call dual frames, which is basically you introduce a computational grid, which basically sits there. It's nice and still. And you can think of it as the co-moving coordinates as the black holes move around. So we have like an inertial coordinate system, which is be like your physical coordinate system, where the black holes orbit around and they get distorted by tidal forces and they merge, and your vector and tensor fields are defined. And in the grid coordinates, where your excision boundaries are nice and spherical and they stay fixed. So your computational domain then is fixed and you can apply the spectral method. And so this requires you to have a mapping that takes you back and forth between these two grids, and the mapping has to be updated all the time as everything moves around. So how do you do that? So here's an example. This is a grid frame for two black holes. This is sort of zoomed in up, and you can imagine this thing rotated around the line joining the two. And then this is what this looks like with the mapping. So here are the two black holes. Very distorted, and they're at some angle, and they're about to merge. And what we do is we use, you don't want to suddenly make changes to your computational grid, because that's a non-smooth procedure, and it will destroy the accuracy of your spectral method. So instead, what we do is we borrow something from engineering, namely the idea of a control system, where you measure by how much, say, your black hole has moved, and there's therefore an error, which is how much it's moved compared with where you would like it to be in when represented through the mapping here. And so the control system then tells you how to update parameters in your mapping in a nice, smooth way so that you can keep everything nicely centered in this frame and yet be able to track everything that's going on here. All right, so here's an example, one of the early simulations, 15 orbits that are shown here. And the computational requirements are actually relatively modest. I mean, that's the beauty of spectral methods. You get pretty high accuracy. You know, this is not a lot of computing, really, by modern standards. And here's the waveform. It's pretty simple. It's two equal masses. It's a very symmetrical situation. This is the blow-up of what's happening here. So one of the first things we could do with this is, you remember I showed you the three phases, the in-spiral, the merger, and the ring down. And the in-spiral, I said, you could use this post-Newtonian approximation. Well, how good is that, a post-Newtonian approximation? When do you have to switch from that analytic work to the numerical simulation? You'd like that to be as late as possible so that your numerical simulation is as short as possible. All right, so how do you get that? Here's the post-Newtonian equation. So, you know, this is the acceleration of one of the holes. You know, this is just gm over r squared. This is the Newtonian force law. And then you see this 1 over c squared. This is an expansion. Easiest to see it in you know, some of these terms in here have a lot. Here's a v squared. So this is like v squared over c squared, which is a small, you know, your small parameter when the things are far apart. So this is called the first post-Newtonian correction. And, you know, people have worked hard, you know, and they've got a second post-Newtonian. You'll see here's a c to the fifth. And, you know, they kept going. And, you know, this is the world record. It's up to c to the seventh, and there are even some hardy souls are trying to do the c to the eighth. All right, so you get this. You can now predict the phase of the wave. So here I'm using this dimensionless parameter x, which is of order v over c squared. It's related to the orbital velocity, angular velocity. And you have a prediction then of the phase as an expansion in this. And you can see there's no hope really of figuring out how, you know, the convergence of this expansion. I mean, it has logarithms and nobody knows any, you can't Pade sum it or anything like that. So how good is it? Well, now we can tell, right? So we take the difference between that analytic prediction and the numerical relativity prediction, and we see it's pretty good, probably better to look at this scale. This is how many cycles before merger. And you can see out here it's pretty good, and then the error blows up as you get close to merger. So you tell me how much error you're willing to tolerate, and then I'll tell you when you have to start your numerical simulation. All right, so now we want to do more realistic things, you know, where we have spins that are not aligned and all kinds of complicated things. And you'll see the waveforms here, this is a 6-to-1 mass ratio. The waveforms start getting pretty complicated. These are the two polarizations. You can see there's a lot of modulation. And we've now produced a catalog. So far, the catalog has 170 waves. In fact, I think there are probably a few more now that we've made publicly available that everybody can use. In fact, a lot of the computations for this were done on SciNet. You know, various parameters, and these can now be used by the community to calibrate waveforms. You know, if there's a detection, people can go back and use these. And we hope, you know, here's little tiny pictures, but each of these is in the catalog, and you can zoom in and do all your things. All right, so I've got a little movie of one of these cases. And this is that 6-to-1 mass ratio with spin. And unlike Newtonian gravity, there are forces that come from the spin that cause the system to precess. You can see how the orbital plane, right, basically tilts during the precession, and these spin vectors also rotate. And so this is much more complicated trajectory than you would get in any kind of simple Newtonian idea where everything stays in a fixed plane. And then down here, you can see the waveform that corresponds to this. And this is the kind of thing that can now be done. So just to emphasize what's going on here, by the time we actually solve this numerically, those 10 equations of Einstein get rewritten. They're in second order form. You rewrite them in first order form. You end up with 50 coupled nonlinear PDEs in three space dimensions that you integrate in time to produce this. And, you know, I just find this amazing, right? I mean, that we've progressed in computational science to where this kind of a problem can be done. Okay. All right, let me talk a little bit about neutron stars, which are another potential source for LIGO. And in particular, we can have binary systems that have, say, two neutron stars, or could have a black hole in a neutron star. So let me talk about black hole and neutron star. So they're important as potential gravitational wave sources. And also, astrophysicists think that these mysterious gamma ray bursts that have been known now for almost 40 years, nobody really knows how they're produced. They're among the most energetic events in the universe. And it's been speculated that somehow these mergers of a black hole and a neutron star, or maybe two neutron stars, are responsible for them. And so this is just a plot showing some counts in a satellite detector of some particular burst. And you can see it's a very short fraction of a second that this is on. And it's assumed that somehow in the matter, as the neutron star spirals in, the black hole can tear it apart, so you get matter, you know, that's in this big tidal tail around the black hole, and you end up maybe with an accretion disk around here, and then somehow or other, you get a jet of something going out that can produce the gamma rays. And, you know, the modeling of this is still in a very primitive state, but that's sort of the next stage. That's what people would really like to do. To sort of follow this all the way from the initial conditions to what might be detected. There's also sort of a new paradigm in astronomy called multi-messenger astronomy, the idea of observing astronomical events with multiple wavelengths. Say it's electromagnetic, you might observe it in light or radio waves or gamma rays, but you could also observe neutrinos that might be emitted from the nuclear reactions and also hopefully from gravitational waves. And putting that all together will give you more insight than if you just use one of these tools. But you can see then the simulation challenge is much greater. Now not only do we have to do Einstein's equations for the relativistic gravity, but now we have the neutron star matter, which can be well modeled as a fluid. So we have hydrodynamics, except it's relativistic hydrodynamics. And then we have to put in, if we really want to do all this, the neutrinos, the light, we have to put in magnetic fields. You can see it rapidly becomes an extremely difficult problem. So here's just some slides from a rather crude simulation, just showing the neutron star. This is the density, and this is the black hole. And then this is the gravitational wave. The neutron star gets torn apart. You end up with the accretion disk. The gravitational wave signal cuts off. But then from this part here, you get from the nuclear reactions, you get a neutrino signal. All right, let me show you just a little animation from one of our simulations. These animations, by the way, are all done by undergraduates at Cornell. I mean, as it's well known, if you want computer graphics, you ask the youngest person around to do it, right? Because they're always the best. All right, and you see the neutron star being torn apart, this tidal tail forming, and then you end up with the accretion disk at the end. So remember, again, this is full relativistic hydrodynamics coupled to full general relativity for the gravitational field. All right, so what's the future of this field? And the answer is all the methods I've described now, the spectral methods for the smooth solutions, for the hydrodynamics here we have shock waves. You can't use spectral methods. You have to use typically finite volume methods with some way of handling the shocks and so on. But if you look at the future, if we really want to do multi-messenger astronomy, we really want to put in all this different kind of physics, and we want to take advantage of the new generation of big machines, then the current algorithms are basically, it seems to me at least, pretty clearly no good. And there's several reasons. So the best one can do, for example, with relativistic hydrodynamics problems, these kinds of simulations I showed you with the neutron stars. So the black hole is probably OK. Spectral methods will probably be good enough. But if you want to put the neutron stars in, right now, the computational errors are sort of about at the 1% level. And that's basically set by the resolution, right? What you can afford in terms of numerical resolution. But many of these problems, you require higher accuracy. And if there are any astronomers in the audience, you might object and say there's no problem in astronomy that needs better than 1% accuracy, right? But actually, that's not true, because, for example, you start off with a neutron star, and you end up with an accretion disk. And if 1% of the initial mass of the neutron star ends up in the accretion disk, and you have only 1% overall accuracy, you have 100% error when you talk about the properties of that accretion disk. Right? So you really do have to do better than we're doing right now. And you know, the simulations just take too long, basically. So, and then the big thing is the methods do not scale to extreme. If you're talking about running on 1 million cores, the current methods just won't work. You can't just say, oh, I'll increase my resolution and run on them, right? And basically the problem, I'll show you sort of what the problem is. Okay, so some of the problems are, you know, the neutron star has a surface, it has shocks, the solutions are not smooth, you have multiple time scales, you know, the the sound waves in the neutron star have one time scale. There's the light travel time, which is associated with gravity. The neutrino time scale can be hundreds of times longer than that. You have multiple spatial scales, so you need some kind of adaptive gridding. The geometry changes during the evolution. You have to handle all these different kinds of physics, preferably on the same grid structure if you can. All right, so how are we going to do it? So let me remind you, so this sort of the current most popular method for doing hydrodynamics in an astrophysical context is a finite volume method. Right, it's just a fancy name for finite differences, really. Well, not quite. But anyway, the idea is that the solution is represented by the average value in each little cell. So here I've shown in one dimension three computational cells. The green is the actual solution. And we approximate that with its average value. So you think of some central point here, which has this blue value, and that represents the solution. Now, the key challenge in the finite volume methods is you have to connect up the solutions at the boundaries here. And the way that's done is you make use of the fact that the hydrodynamic equations, and also, by the way, Einstein's equations, can be written as conservation equations. They're equations that describe conservation of mass, of energy, of momentum, and so on. And so basically, the way that this cell influences this cell is by a flux of energy, momentum, mass into this cell. And so what you need is a recipe here for the flux that you need to transfer both ways between the cells. That's the flux reconstruction problem. There's a huge literature on this, on how to do this, and people have very good algorithms that can handle shocks pretty well. But you can see the problem with this method is if you want high accuracy, then, you know, this is such a crude approximation to the solution. If you want high accuracy, what you need is to couple together cells so that information from here can be used to approximate the variation of the solution. And that spoils the scaling. As soon as you couple cells, as soon as you have a stencil that's wide, then if these cells reside on different processes and you're coupling many of them together, then if you try to scale that up, you soon get dominated by the communication costs. So I don't believe there's any way that these methods will work as I've described them on a million CPU machine. Now, what about spectral methods? So the idea in spectral methods, you remember, is we have within each cell a local basis. So here I've shown a basis which is a constant and then a linear function, right? So just the first two polynomials, and you can imagine a quadratic and higher and so on. Okay, so now the solution inside each element is an expansion. So with my two basis functions, I can make a straight line of some slope, right? So I have a better approximation within each cell. But the standard way of connecting spectral methods is still have to do something here at the boundary. There's some kind of penalty method that gets imposed to match these up. And that typically is unstable if you have shocks. Right? So you have to do something special if you want to handle shocks. And there's no really good way to do this if you want to do three-dimensional time-dependent spectral methods. All right, discontinuous Galerkin tries to have the best of both worlds. So you still have a local basis to expand the solution in, so you can get high order locally just by using more and more polynomials here. You don't have to talk to your neighbor to do that. There's still a flux reconstruction problem, but because you don't require the solutions to be continuous here, that's the D part of the discontinuous, all you require is that that discontinuity go to zero in the limit of infinite resolution. Right? You want the error that comes from this to be no bigger than the error that comes from this approximation. So that gives you much greater freedom than with spectral methods. And in particular, nearly all of the methods that have been developed for finite volume techniques can be used here. So you can bring all that expertise to bear on this problem. And not quite, that's why I put quotes on arbitrary. So the advantage is you still get exponential convergence for smooth regions, but wherever there's a shock, you can still handle it. And because this is a very local method, it scales very well to big machines. So I believe that this is a very promising technique to look ahead to. So this is just from Hesthaven's book where he compares different methods, finite difference, finite volume, and so on. And you see DG is the one that has check marks in nearly all the columns. Right? You don't have to worry about what these things actually mean. All right, but there are challenges. So first of all, how do you parallelize a code like this efficiently? So it's not good enough to just distribute each cell or a bunch of cells on each CPU, because especially if you're doing multi-physics, then the amount of computation that has to be done in one spatial region is not necessarily the same. You know, over here you might have a lot of neutrinos being produced, and there's a very complicated calculation for the equation of state of nuclear matter and so on. Over here, things could be pretty quiet and so on. It's very quick to do those calculations. So if you parallelize in the that's traditionally how we parallelize, just spatially distributing things, then these cores over here will spend all their time waiting for these cores to finish. Right? You have very bad load balancing. So instead, you probably want to go to the root of what's called task-based parallelism, where you have a whole bunch of cores that are waiting for instructions, and you can then construct your list of tasks, you know, calculate the flux in this zone, calculate the flux here, update this, do that, and so on. And then every time a CPU is available, you just send it a task to do. So the challenge with this is there are no good packages for doing this, right? It's not like using MPI where you can rely on many years of development in order to parallelize your code. And so, you know, the last thing that physicists want to do is have to get into some really fancy computer science issues and come up with a package to do this. So plea number one, if there are people in the audience who are interested in this, this is a huge opportunity to contribute to all of computational science. Similarly, you want to do local time stepping if you have different grid sizes. You have different Courant conditions locally, you want to be able to do that. This is the jargon for being able to adaptively choose the size of your mesh to control the errors, right? So where solution is rapidly varying, you want both small, you may want smaller elements or higher order polynomials, so you want a scheme for doing that. There's still a lot of research to be done for applying the hydrodynamic fluxes to these discontinuous Galerkin methods. So let me conclude by just saying help is wanted, and if anybody is interested, please come and volunteer to me. Thank you.
So, time for questions.
So it's a very interesting talk. At the very end, with the task-based parallelism approach or a master-slave approach, the problem then becomes, on a large number of processors, the amount of work that's got to be done by the master to generate load. I mean, there have been some other ways to do it. I know with parallel SPH codes where you sort of transfer work across the boundaries. Have you thought about doing that?
Yeah, I was... You know, very sketchy here. So certainly, this is a very complicated subject, and there are many schemes that have been proposed, which involve, you know, work stealing, is one kind of thing where you might have local queues. You know, you might have a node, which, you know, these days maybe has a dozen cores, but soon might have 100 cores, and so you might have local queues on each node which manage those 100 cores, but then if this node detects that node, its neighbor, is, you know, not too busy, it maybe can ship off some items from its queue to that queue and so on. So you can rapidly, it becomes very, you know, it's a complicated problem.
Next question.
Is it clear how violent a violation to, how violent a perturbation to general relativity would you have to have for those waveforms to become useless? Or rather, for you to be unable to detect? So if you introduce a perturbation about general relativity, yeah, how big that perturbation has to be so that the waveforms are to disturb?
You're talking about in the early phase where you do an analytic calculation? Because the numerical solution is exact. It's up to the, you know, you're solving the full problem exactly.
No, I mean, if you have a theory which is not general relativity.
Oh, okay.
A perturbation,
so you want,
in theory,
you want
space.
To look for deviations from general relativity. Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually a, that's probably a problem that hasn't been addressed sufficiently. The way that I think is the best way to do that is you need some kind of a meta-theory, a theory of possible theories of gravity, which maybe has parameters in it. And then if general relativity is correct, you know, maybe the parameters all have the value 1 or 0 or something. And then you try to interpret your measurements as constraining those parameters. You know, how are they really 1 to within some error, or can you detect deviations? My guess is, I mean, this is such a difficult problem that my guess is that certainly for the initial detections by LIGO, the expectations are that the signal-to-noise, I mean, we really are going to be in the situation that I showed, where that signal is really buried in the noise. So without good templates, you're not going to see the signal at all. So the best chance of seeing a deviation from general relativity is you get an event where you're lucky enough, you pick it up when the sources are relatively far apart. So gravity is weak. We almost know from solar system experiments that you have to be close to general relativity's values in that regime. So the idea is you might be able to pick up the wave, get the signal in that regime, and then it takes about 10 minutes for the signal to spiral in to, say, to the merger. And so now you would have a prediction from general relativity of what it should look like in the strong field regime. And then you might get lucky, or depending on your point of view, unlucky, and it disagrees. Okay, and that's probably the best hope of seeing something wrong.
So at the beginning, I think you said that the outcome of this research will be that we'll know whether Einstein's theory was right. So for those of us who are not astrophysicists, what does this really mean to the average man on the street or to the politician who has to write the check for, long tunnels or big computers?
Right. Well, so first of all, I hope I don't have to explain to this audience, right? I mean, we all understand that advances in science lead to benefits for society that are not always foreseeable, right? That, whether you take, what went into the cell phone in my pocket, whether it's, even just the GPS, which, by the way, uses general relativity, whatever it is, right? The people who made those original discoveries were not planning to develop cell phones or to improve cell phones. So we all believe that there is a continual process of basic science, and it's impossible to know exactly what influence the work we're doing now will have on science 30 or 40 years from now. So the only way I can answer the question really is in a short, I can't give you how society will benefit later on. I can just give you the short-term answer, namely that within the field of physics and in the field of astronomy, especially in astronomy, we've built an edifice on the idea that there are black holes there, right? I mean, if you look, how do quasars work? Oh, it's a black hole at the center that's powering, you know, the jets and so on. Everything is built on this premise that if you get enough mass in a small enough volume, it makes a black hole. But from a fundamental physics point of view, we have no test of that. So you can look upon one aspect of LIGO is it's a test of fundamental physics, whether our current best theory for gravity in the non-quantum regime is general relativity or not. After the first detection, first few detections, then, you know, it becomes not physics anymore, it becomes astronomy. We use it as a way to learn about the universe.
I have two questions, if I may. The first one is related to the previous question. I'm a bit perplexed by the answer, because the weak field regime and the solar system tests say that alternative theories should be close to general relativity in a stationary situation. That's what you described is far from being a stationary situation. I could, even when the two objects are very far and gravity is weak, you could still consider having scalar radiation or something like that will sufficiently deviate from the.
No, we have very good limits on that from the binary pulsar.
Okay.
So the Hulse-Taylor pulsar tells us that scalar radiation is weak. You can't have an arbitrary amount. We have constraints on that. So if you put all those constraints, that's what I meant. But even that, the Hulse-Taylor thing, which only won, it won the Nobel Prize and so on, but it's only V over C to the fifth. So in that sense, I mean, it's weak gravity.
My other question is, when you showed this comparison between the post-Newtonian and the numerical simulations about the merger, is there any chance we could see that again?
Yeah.
So what order in post-Newtonian theory is used for the...
So it's general relativity, right? It's a general relativistic... You assume general relativity...
Sure. With what order...
The order that I showed you. It's that C to the 7. It's the 3.5.
Oh, okay.
3.5 PN.
So the question I have is, in a sense, if I were to go one order higher, how much better would I do?
We don't know. Because the series is irregular. So I didn't show this here, but you can make a plot where you keep adding one more term in the series and seeing how well the error agrees. And it jumps all over the place. There's no uniformity in how good the approximation is. So that's why this was an important result, because we had no way, by looking at the series itself, normally, if you have a convergent series, you can just look at the terms and you can figure out. Right? We can't do that with post-Newtonian.
If you were to plot that curve with one order lower PPN theory,
it's not as good as this. It's not as good as this. But if I did it successively, I wouldn't have been able to predict by how much the change would be.
As a non-physicist, the last slide was interesting to me, especially because you're talking about new ways of solving very complex problems that use HPC, and it seemed to me that one of the advances that you might make that might benefit all of us is essentially new ways to do parallelism, for example, and I'm just wondering whether you have ideas that fall outside of the existing framework that we currently work under of data and task parallelism that might actually help you deal with your massive computation.
No, I think that I belong to the school which says that you should concentrate on the things that you know about and try to get experts to help you with the things that you don't know about. So, in that list there, I think the only unique contribution that our group is making is arguing that this is the way forward. And you need all of these ingredients if you want to make the next step. But as far as how to implement these and so on, I hope we can rely on other people's work to tell us what to do. I fear that for the first one, that's not true. There's very little out there on general purpose implementations for task-based parallelism. There's a lot of specialized stuff for particular applications.
Can you elaborate a bit on what is the main obstacle for scalability to 1 million cores that you mentioned? I seem to understand that load balancing is a problem, yeah. But is it the only one,
no,
or there is additional?
No, problems? So I think that it's inherent to the current algorithms, right? Whether it's the finite volume method or the spectral method and so on, so the spectral method is no good because it can't handle shocks. So if you want to handle shocks, which we need for the astrophysical problem, not just this one, but many astrophysical problems, so the current technique that's used is finite volume techniques. And finite volume techniques, in order to get high order, you have to couple multiple elements, and then the non-locality of that means that if you increase your grid, that you spend all your time in communication costs. So, you know, whether it's 3,000 or 10,000, that's about the current limit of finite volume codes in terms of number of CPUs, where after that you start getting dominated by communication costs. And I think that it's inherent to the algorithm. You need to change the algorithm.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.